Again, the shiur is being sponsored in memory of Rav Shlomo ben Rav Avraham, Zecher Tzadik Livrocha, and hopefully we will learn good Torah in his memory. So what I want to do with you, with your permission, is look in the 45 minutes or so, 50 minutes that we have, at three distinct messianic visions in Torah. Did everyone get the source sheet? You got the source sheet? Great. Meaning we hear a lot about Mashiach. People talk about Mashiach. People seem to mention it at the end of every drosher. It's like what rabbis feel they need to do. You know, Mashiach should come soon, etc. But very often, I find people have a very confused understanding of what exactly that means. What Mashiach are we talking about? Is it going to happen overnight in a, you know, flashbang? Do we need to build a temple? Does Mashiach need to build a temple? How does it work with all the offerings, the sacrifices, etc.? Now, obviously, I am not going to give a comprehensive detailed understanding of Mashiach in the 45-50 minutes that we've got. I could do that if you give me a series, and we could do it over a series of five, maybe 5 hours is probably good to go through it, because there's a lot to bring in. But I do want to give you an overview, and I want to try and put it into three categories. And again, I feel, maybe it's because I used to be a lawyer, and I have this kind of mind which needs to have things in little, you know, organized compartments. If you can put things into these three understandings, the three visions in Torah, then it begins, I think, to make sense. It's not 100% separate. They do overlap. There's a kind of in-between joint approach to some of these. But if you get them in these three ideas, then hopefully it'll work. Just to give an overview, the three ideas as follows. There is the rationalist understanding of Maimonides, of the Rambam. Okay? And he understands that Mashiach is a completely natural phenomenon, a political phenomenon, where the attitude of all the people in the world, certainly the Jews, but indeed everybody, changes in such a way that they no longer want to kill each other and fight with each other, but they want to cooperate with each other, speak to each other, live together in some kind of harmony, share the resources that the world has, protect and preserve those resources. And that's his vision. It doesn't require miracles. It doesn't require some kind of supernatural intervention. It's all a naturalistic perspective. And in the Rambam, Maimonides' view, this is quite different to Olam Haba. Olam Haba, when we talk about Olam Haba, the world to come, when he uses that phrase, he means the soul world, the world that people go to, whatever go to means in a non-physical world, when they die. And obviously we'll talk a little bit about the Olam Haba aspect of it, but he says these two things are completely independent of each other. Okay? So that's view number one, or vision number one. Vision number two is a mystical vision. I've called it the Ramban Nachmanides, and I'll probably call them Maimonides and Nachmanides just to make it easier than confusing which is the Rambam and the Ramban. But the Nachmanides vision, Nachmanides lived a generation or so after Maimonides. His vision, he's a mystic. He's an early Kabbalist. He's a pre-Zohar Kabbalist, or pre the publication of the Zohar. But he's a Kabbalist, and he has a mystical view of Mashiach, where Mashiach is a combination of the physical and the spiritual together once again. That is Olam Haba. For Nachmanides, Olam Haba and Mashiach become the same thing. And also the resurrection of the dead. It's all one big thing. And it's like the return to the Garden of Eden. The Garden of Eden was a spiritual, physical combination, a form of life that we don't really understand. And that's what we'll return to when Mashiach comes. Okay? And of course, it'll be completely miraculous. And, very importantly, a big difference between those two approaches, for Maimonides, the Torah will remain 100% the same as it is today, because all the time people are alive, Torah applies to them. Only when a person dies, goes to Olam Haba, then they no longer have Torah. Obviously, they don't have a physical essence, they have a physical being. But the time of Mashiach, says Maimonides, is physical, and therefore Torah will not change. And that is one of his 13 principles of faith. Principle number 9, that the Torah will never change. Obviously, specific applications will change because we will have an opportunity to do things that we can't do right now, like bring offerings in a temple. But the Torah in principle won't change. Whereas for the Ramban, for Nachmanides, why would I need a Torah in the Garden of Eden? We're not even physical people in the same way that we are right now. We don't need to keep kosher. We don't need to keep Shabbat. I don't even know what kosher and Shabbat is in the Garden of Eden, etc. So it's a completely new vision of Torah, an entirely different thing. Okay, fine. And the third vision, which overlaps a little bit between them, is an apocalyptic vision, which brings meaning there's going to be some kind of terrible suffering at the end, followed by some kind of Mashiach. And that brings in the concepts of Mashiach ben Yosef. the Mashiach from the tribe, as it were, of Joseph. It's not actually necessarily genealogically from the tribe, but a different kind of Mashiach which precedes Mashiach ben David. Okay? And we'll see that there's an overlap there. But if you can keep these three things as three circles, make a kind of Venn diagram in your head. There's the Maimonidean rationalist approach where Mashiach is purely physical, not supernatural. There's Nachmanides' Kabbalistic, mystical approach where Mashiach is completely supernatural and joined physical and spiritual. And then there's Mashiach ben Yosef, which may or may not, depending on your view, come before the whole Messianic process, and we'll talk a bit about what they are. Okay, so let's start a little bit. I'm going to zip through some of these sources. I put them in Hebrew and in English so you can look at them in your own time as well, whatever suits you best. So let's start with Maimonides. I brought you five sources on Maimonides, and we'll look at these quite quickly. And they're very straightforward. Maimonides often is the most spoken out, the most explicated version of this, because he dedicates two entire chapters at the end of his Mishneh Torah. His Mishneh Torah is his halachic work. He goes through all the halachic principles and details. It's a massive, massive work, 14 volumes in 1,000 chapters. The last two of those 1,000 chapters are the laws of Mashiach. So you see, by the very fact that he has it in a halacha sefer, he sees it as an extension of the halachic life of a Jew at the end of days. So he look at what he says in number one. Hamelecha Mashiach atid la'amod. There will in future be a king, Mashiach. Again, king, what does king mean? Does king mean a man with a crown on his head like King Charles? Or does king mean a government? Does king mean a... We'll see. Well, we're not going to see today, but just keep an open mind on that. He will come. V'la'achzir malchus beis David le'yoshna. He will return the kingship of the house of David, it's what it originally was, HaMemshala HaRishona, to its original government. Ubonim Migdash, he will build a temple. Sounds like the Mashiach has to build a temple, not us beforehand. Umekabetz Nidchei Yisrael, he will gather in the exiles, which is interesting. Do we need to wait for Mashiach before the exiles gather in? If so, what is it that we are experiencing today? Is it anything to do with Mashiach? Is it completely unconnected with Mashiach? Is this order needed, or could it be in a different order? V'chozrin kol ha-mishpatim miyamav. Like I said, all the laws will return. K'shehayu mikodem, just like they were before. Makrivim korbanot, will bring offerings. Osim shmitim, will keep shmitah, the yovlot, and the yovel, the jubilee, k'chol mitzvatam ha-mura b'torah. Everything will be as it was. V'chol mi she'enu ma'amin bo, anyone who doesn't believe that Mashiach is the goal of this, or mi she'enu mechakel b'yotzo, someone who doesn't wait, someone who's too rushed and wants to hurry Mashiach, or someone who gives up entirely, not only does he deny all the words of the prophets in the Nevi'im, in the Torah itself there are explicit references, says the Rambam, to Mashiach. Shehari Torah he'idu alav, the Torah tells us and predicts Mashiach, and he brings various psukim at the end of Dvarim where it says we will come back to the land and we will rebuild the land, etc. By the way, for the Rambam, the main focus, one of the main focuses of Mashiach is coming back to the land. Because obviously you cannot set up a new government, a new state, has to be a political state in Israel, without a return of at least some of the Jewish people to the land of Israel. And I would just mention that the proportion of the Jewish people that have already, in our lifetime, returned to the land of Israel is way in excess of anything that had ever happened in the whole of Jewish history. Even in the Exodus from Egypt, the rabbis say that only 1/5 of the Jews actually left Egypt. Everyone else was just not into the project, and they stayed behind. And therefore, now we have a half, more or less, of the Jewish people who, Baruch Hashem, Kein Yirbu, Moshe Kam, have come to Israel. Certainly when they built the second temple, a tiny proportion of the Jewish people came from Babylon to rebuild the second temple. So we're already in a very historically unprecedented place. Fine. So there is going to be a melech, there's going to be a government, there's going to be a political body. Number two. Aval, tovat chayei olam haba. But when we talk about the world to come, ein la erech v'dimion. We have no way of describing the world to come. V'lo dimu ha-nevim. And the prophets never spoke about it. Nothing you read in Yeshayahu, in Isaiah, in Jeremiah, in Yechezkel, nothing to do with olam haba. K'dei she'lo yifchatu otar li b'dimion, because they don't want to diminish it by trying to describe it. And that's when Isaiah says, Ayin lo ra'ata Elohim zelotecha. No eye has seen it apart from you, God. Ya'aseh, he will do it, lemechakelo, for those who wait for it. Kaloima hatova shelo ra'ata otah. A navi, no eye of the Nevi'im has ever seen it. Ela asa otah Elohim la'adam shelechakelo. But this is waiting for all people when they get to Olam Haba. That's what they'll experience. Amru Chachamim, the rabbi said, Kol ha'Nevi'im kolam lo nitnabo eli yimus ha-Mashiach. Everything you read in the prophets, in Isaiah, etc., is all about Mashiach. This physical reality, political reality, it's not about Olam Haba. Now, I'm not going to give you a whole shir on Olam Haba. I mean, how could I when he said we don't know what it is? But perhaps the best way of explaining it is Olam Haba is a return to a union with God on some level. And therefore, just as we don't understand what it would mean to be God, to be part of God, we don't even know what part would mean when we understand that God is a unit as a whole which cannot be divided into parts. So we honestly have no idea about how it feels to be part of that reality of God. And whatever people say to you about Olam Haba, honestly, is just made up because nobody really knows what it is. It may be a thing to say to people to make them feel better, you know, your grandma's looking down on you and all that's nice. I mean, I'm not saying it's wrong. But I'm just saying they really don't know what they're talking about because we don't know what Olam Haba is. And we don't need to because the Torah is focused on Olam Hazeh. It's focused on how to live a life. Now, over the page. Says number 3. Al Ya'ale al Datach. We're still in Maimonides. Don't for 1 minute think Shehamelech HaMashiach Tzarech La'asot Otot Umoftim. That the Mashiach needs to do signs and wonders, supernatural things. Umechadish Tvarim Ba'olam, or make new realities in the physical world. Or Umechayim Mesim, or bring back the dead. Mashiach doesn't need to bring back the dead. Those three words, got the Rambam into some hot water. Even in his life, he was very hard to attack while he was alive because he was undisputedly the senior rabbi certainly of the Sephardic Jewish world. But even while he was alive, people said, "What? Are you not talking about, you know, do you deny the resurrection of the dead?" Now, we're not going to talk today about the resurrection of the dead because I can't do that in the time frame. But there is such a thing, and that is the Rambam's 13th principle of the 13 principles. Meitim Yechaya El, we sing in Yigdal, right? So, what does the Rambam mean when he says Melech HaMashiach will have nothing to do with the resurrection? So, he says, later in other places, that he means that the two things are not necessarily connected. That the resurrection of the dead could come before Mashiach comes, which, by the way, is a nice support for the Chabadnikim, who say that the Rebbe will come back to life and then be the Mashiach. And you might turn around and say, well, I don't think that's going to happen. But they can turn around and say, yeah, but it could happen. The Rambam actually accepts that possibility. And the Chabadnikim, by the way, Chabad, strongly follow the Maimonidean perspective on Mashiach. The Rebbe has said on a number of occasions, we paskin like the Rambam when it comes to Mashiach. But the Rambam says the resurrection has got nothing to do directly with Mashiach. Maybe before, maybe during, maybe after. But you should know that during his life, even when he said that, people didn't believe him. They said to him, we don't think you really mean that. We think what you really mean is life after death. You're really talking about Olam Haba. And he denied it, and they didn't listen, and da da da. And to this day, there is a big debate as to what exactly the Rambam thought that the resurrection of the dead was, and we can't have a class about that now. But whatever it is, it's nothing to do directly with Mashiach. It doesn't have to be. Okay? He doesn't have to do that. The second line of number 3, all of these things, shahatipshim omrim, foolish people think that that's what Mashiach does. It's just not true. Rabbi Akiva chacham gadol mechachmei mishnahaya. Rabbi Akiva was a great rabbi of the Mishnaic period. For who haya nosikelav shele ben Koziba hamelech, he was the armor bearer for Bar Kochba. Now, I don't know if this means he was his schlepper, you know, and he schlepped all his swords, but he was like the trailblazer, I think. What it means, he was the one who really, and he backed Bar Kochba, and incorrectly, you know, we don't believe in papal infallibility. Rabbi Akiva really thought that Bar Kochba was the Mashiach, and he had good reasons for thinking that, and it turned out that he was wrong. For who haya omer alav, and he would say about him, shehu melech ha-mashiach. V'dimahu, and he thought, v'chol chachmei doro. And all, certainly many of the rabbis in Rabbi Kiva's generation, shehu melech ha-mashiach, ashenerag ba'avonot, until eventually he was killed. Okay? V'kevin shenerag, until he was killed through his sins. Not ashenu mashiach. We know that he wasn't the Mashiach. V'lo sha'alu mimenu chachamim, lo od v'lo mofed. No one ever asked him to do a miracle. He was a military commander. No one asked him to split the sea, walk on water, who knows what. He was a military man. And they thought he was the Mashiach. By the way, when it says, you can't be Mashiach if you're a dead Mashiach, okay, is this, they throw this back again at Chabad. I'm not a Chabad Hasid, but nevertheless they say, no, it doesn't say that a dead person can't be Mashiach. It says Bar Kochba was killed for his sins. It wasn't a tzaddik who died in a normal way, and therefore it's got nothing to do with the Rebbe. Okay, everyone has an answer for everything in Judaism. There's never, you know, if you think you've come up with one of my Rosh Yeshiva used to have a great line, still has. He says, no one should tell you that Judaism has all the answers, but Judaism for sure asks all the questions. you won't come up with a question that no one's thought of before. Almost certainly not. Okay. The Ikar HaDvarim Kachahem. The main thing he says at the end is the Torah will not change, and people shouldn't think the Torah will change, etc. So again, no miracles. Again, number four. Let's go quickly through this. I'm trying to just build a picture. Al Yale El Alev. Don't think, says the Rambam, that when Mashiach comes, the world's nature will change. Or there'll be some new natural forces or natural rules of nature. The world will continue exactly as it is physically. When it says in Isaiah, that the wolf will lie down, will live with the lamb and the leopard, with the goat. It doesn't mean literally the animals will become vegetarians. Now, if you're a Kabbalist, if you're a mystic, maybe the animals will become vegetarians, because in the Garden of Eden, the animals were vegetarians. They were allowed to eat only grain, not even fruit. Fruit was for people. They're just the vegetables were for animals, but they were vegetarians. So Rama says, no. Animals will still eat animals. It's a mashal, it's a parable. What is it for? Inyan adavah sheyiu Yisrael yoshim levetachim rishay olam, that the Jews will be able to live with those people who were the wicked of the world, the lions and the wolves who were wicked in the world, and mushulim b'ze'eva namer, who are compared to wolves and lions, and he brings a pasuk. V'yachsru kolam ledata emet, and all of these people who used to be rishayim, who wicked, the non-Jewish nations, who tried, not every non-Jewish nation is wicked, but those who were, will return to what he calls the dat ha'emet, the true religion. Now, again, big question. What's he talking about? Have they all got to become Jewish? Most people understand the Maimonides mean, no, they don't all have to be Jewish. What's the dat ha'emet? What's the true religion for non-Jews? To be ethical, not to murder, to keep the seven laws of Noah, etc. To be prepared to live with people, not steal from people, not kill people. Everyone will return to that. The lo yigzalu, they won't steal. The lo yashchita, they won't destroy. Elo yochle davar hamutzah benachas Yisrael, they will eat normally and share just together with the Jewish people. And he brings another pasuk there. V'chein kol yotzei be'elu advarim haksuvim be'inyan Mashiach, and everything it ever says about Mashiach, mishalim heim, it's always a parable. It's never literal. Ubi yemois hamelech haMashiach yivada lachol le'ezid davar hayu mashal. And when it happens, then we'll be able to retroactively say, ah, yes, this was this and this was this. Uma'in yin ramzu bahen. And finally, he ends off in number four. Amru chachamim ein bein olam azeh le'mois haMashiach ela shibud malchiyot bilvad. There's no real difference between now and the times of Mashiach, other than political difference. There won't be oppression, not just against the Jews, but against anybody. And this is a very important idea. For the Rambam, the world will be completely transformed when Mashiach comes, but not because of a miracle, just because of a change of attitude. In theory, the United Nations is a messianic idea. Okay? It's far from perfect. But if you'd have told the Rambam that there's such a thing as the United Nations, he would immediately have said, yes, the idea that people talk to each other rather than kill each other, however imperfect that is a step towards this vision. And by the way, the people who founded the United Nations knew this full well, and that's why if you go to First Avenue in New York and you look across the road from the United Nations, there's a pasuk, there's a verse from Yeshayahu written on the wall about messianic times. They were very conscious of that this is a move towards a messianic redemption. Okay, hopefully it'll work better, it'll get better. But people will still get sick, people will still get ill, people will still die, people will still go to hospital, but think of a world in which instead of pouring all the resources we have into military research, we pour those resources into medical research. Just think, even though people would in theory get sick, to think what we could cure. Think how old people could become, you know, if we could just crack all of those issues. So it's a natural world, but it's a transformed world. And I just brought you in the last source on Maimonides, number five, and he says, but Oysa Hazman, at that time when Mashiach comes, lo yasham, lo rav, lo milchama, there will be no hunger, there will be no war, lo kina, there will be no jealousy, v'tacharut, and unfair competition, shehatova, tia, mushpat, harba, there'll be good all over the world, v'kol hama adanim mitsuyim ka'afar, and all of the wonderful joys and pleasures of the world will be present there just like dust. Again, non-miraculously. The Rambam's making a very, you know, socialist point in a sense, which is that there's enough money to go round if we just share it. There shouldn't be anyone hungry. There shouldn't be anybody fighting. There shouldn't be anybody starving. We just need to share the resources. It's actually, and what the Rambam does is he gives the Jewish people an imperative to work towards a vision of Mashiach. And this is actually very important. The vision that we're often told, which we're going to get to next, which is the mystical vision, is that everything's getting worse and worse and worse and worse and worse. And every generation is going down and down. And you hear this again and again and again. Things have never been this bad. And sometimes people say that and I think, what planet do you live on? Do you have any idea what it was like living in the 14th century? And you think that this is worse than then? You have no clue. You would not want to live in a world with no antibiotics. You would not want to live in a world with no healthcare, with no technology. And you think this is the worst generation. People are less moral in this generation than in previous generations. You've not been reading the history books. You know, you really haven't. There's almost nothing happening today that wasn't happening at some point in history. Oh, but today, you know, yeah, go back to ancient Greece and look at the sexual morality of ancient Greece. Today is like, the Vatican compared to then. You know, I still don't know what happens in the Vatican. Don't quote me. Okay, fine. Okay, whatever. The point is that the Rambam doesn't subscribe to this. He says, no, the world is potentially getting better and better and better. Obviously, it's going in bumps. But we have a social imperative to push the world to the point that Mashiach can actually come. It's up to us. And when we get there, then you won't need a miracle because we'll be in the point that Mashiach can then come and we'll be already in that place. Of course, if you subscribe to the vision that everything's going down, then nothing short of a complete miracle will be able to bring it back up to the place it needs to go. But it's important to know that this is the, and I feel that also, just to mention Chabad again, their very activist approach in helping the Jewish people, in being in places which no one else wants to go, I feel that they subscribe to this idea that we have to be the ones that actually go out there and make the change. And that's, I think, what inspires the shluchim, etc., etc. And I think they're following this Maimonidean vision that social action and social justice we have to bring and then bring Mashiach. Okay, that's vision number one. Any questions on vision number one? I mean, probably 100 questions, but like, shall we just go through them and then at the end we'll have some time. Let's look at vision number two. Vision number two is the Kabbalistic vision. And I brought you one source and I could have brought you 20 sources, but one should do it. Let's read this one in English. This is from the Ramban, Nachmanides, in his commentary on the Chumash. And there, at the end of the Chumash, in the same sukkim that the Ramban was quoting before, that you will do tshuva and you'll come back, etc. And by the way, tshuva means also tshuva, return to the land, as well. And the Eternal, your God, will circumcise your heart. What does it mean to have a mila, to cut away a part of the heart? The following subject is very apparent from Scripture. Since the time of creation, man has had the power to do as he pleased, to be righteous or wicked. We have free choice. This grant of free will applies likewise to the entire Torah period, so that people can gain merit upon choosing the good and punishment for preferring evil. But in the days of the Messiah, the choice of their genuine good will be natural. The heart will not desire the improper. It will have no craving whatever for it. This is the, quote, circumcision, unquote, mentioned here. For lust and desire are the foreskin of the heart, and circumcision of the heart means it will not covet or desire evil. Man will return at that time to what he was before the sin of Adam, when by his nature he did what should properly be done, and there were no conflicting desires in his will, as I've explained in Sefer Bereishis. It is this which Scripture says in the book of Jeremiah, "Behold, days are coming, says the Eternal, I will make a new covenant," a Brit Chadashah is the Hebrew. I will make a new covenant. By the way, if you're a Christian, your ears prick up at this point, and you say, oh, the New Testament, what's going on? The Greek translates the word Brit here as testament, which is interesting because it's covenant, which is a little bit different. With the house of Israel and with the house of Judah, not according to the covenant that I made with their fathers, meaning a new Torah, a totally new Torah. But this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, says the Eternal. I will put my law in their inward parts. They will have the Torah inside them. They won't need it outside them. And in their heart will I write it. This is a reference to the annulment of the evil instincts and the natural performance by the heart of its proper function. The death of the Yetzer Hara, the end of free will as we know it. Yes, Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden had some level of free will. They chose to do something that they weren't meant to do, but they didn't have it inside them. They weren't conflicted like we are, constantly conflicted with this feeling of doing the wrong thing, the right thing, the wrong thing. Our whole life is this dialectic between good and evil inside us. The snake, of course, in the story of Gan Eden, represents the external Yetzer Hara trying to get inside them to, if you like, infect them both so that they will have this now inside of them. And if you understand that, then you understand that when you read the Midrashim, which have really quite explicit sexual imagery of the snake and of Chava, etc. That's what's really happening there. It's this idea of it trying to penetrate inside them and become part of them, that when Mashiach comes, we'll be reversed. So we won't be like we are now. We'll just be different people. We won't need a Torah because we'll just have no inclination the way we do to do what we do. The world will be an entirely different place. There'll be a Brit Chadashah, for which, by the way, the Rambam would say this is heretical. No less than. It's in breach of the ninth principle. The Rambam would say, I don't care if you think it's heretical. It's correct, you know. And he would therefore subscribe to that vision. And by the way, this is actually very important because if you subscribe to this Kabbalistic, more mystical vision that Torah will fall away when Mashiach comes, then once you think that the Messiah has come, then you start making changes in Torah justified on the basis that, well, Torah has to change when the Messiah comes. We're not living in the same world we had before. This has happened to us in a number of different occasions. Well, Christianity, of course, is one, which is, well, the Messiah has come now, they would say, and therefore we do not need the same Torah. And here we can quote these verses in Jeremiah. Shabtai Tzvi, when Shabtai Tzvi came to, you know, declare that he was the Messiah. I'm not getting into the whole Shabtai Tzvi saga. It's fascinating. In the 1660s, he didn't know if he was the Messiah. He was convinced by his right-hand man, Nathan of Gaza, who was a great spin doctor. And he said, yeah, you are the Messiah, and let's make it, you know, real. And once people said the Messiah has come, then they started breaking Torah because they said, well, we don't need the same Torah. We can now eat on Tisha B'Av. Maybe we should eat on Tisha B'Av. Maybe we should eat Chelev. We should dafka. We should specifically do those things that used to be the worst Averas, the worst prohibitions, can now be flipped because it's a new covenant. It's a new reality. We can roll it all back. You know, women said we don't want to go to the mikveh anymore because we don't need to do that now because we're now rolled back to the Garden of Eden. The Frankists, who took this to the next stage in the 18th century, were even involved in organized wife swapping rings because they were saying this is now a holy act of sinning in the new covenant for the sake of... You could take this anywhere you want, and it flies completely off the rails. And we've had this experience, and therefore many people are worried about this. There is even a theory that the early reform movement, in many ways, were piggybacking on this idea. They obviously weren't coming off the specific sources, but they were saying, well, we're now living in the utopian age. The utopian age is when we have enlightenment, when we have emancipation, when we're allowed out of the ghettos. We don't need Torah anymore because this is the time of Mashiach. The 19th century is the time of Mashiach. And by the way, we find that very hard now, looking back from the 21st century, to understand how anyone living in the 19th century would think that they were living in a messianic age, but that's because we are jaded by the 20th century, and they weren't. Meaning anyone who lived through the 20th century realizes it was just a complete pipe dream, and they weren't living in any kind of messianic age. So, but there's a lot going on with this vision, but this is Nachmanides' vision, and I think actually when most people talk to you about Mashiach, I think this is what they're really saying. Mashiach's going to suddenly come, and it's going to be a flashbang, and all of a sudden everything's going to change, and don't worry, life will be perfect, etc. No one's going to get sick, no one's going to die, all the dead are going to come back to life. And I think when people tell kids, or even adults, about Mashiach, I think this is really what they're implying. This is Nachmanides' vision. But it comes with certain dangers and certain, you know, health warnings that if you take it too literally, then it becomes a problem. By the way, the idea of predicting Mashiach coming and saying Mashiach is almost here, Mashiach is almost here, the Rambam is very unhappy about that. Maimonides, he said it just gets people all wound up and you're just going to disappoint them and never ever predict the coming of Mashiach. But it's very hard not to. You know, when communities are in stress and trauma and they need to be kind of picked up. And even Maimonides, when he was writing to the Jews of Yemen, said, don't worry, Mashiach has to come in the next like 50, 75 years or whatever, even though he was the one that said, never say that. Because what can you do? People need, you know, chizuk. People need to be supported. Fine. That's the Kabbalistic image. Obviously, there's lots more we can say about that. But that is one, the second, if you like, vision of Mashiach. The third, and final, at least for today, vision is Mashiach ben Yosef. Mashiach ben Yosef is fascinating because it's already mentioned in the Gemara. Let's look at number 7. The Gemara quotes a pasuk from Zechariah that talks about a great eulogy that will happen one day in the future. Bayom Hahu, on that day, says Zechariah. Yigdal ha-misped b'Yerushalayim. There will be an enormous eulogy, mourning in Jerusalem. K'misped Hadad Rimon b'Bekat Megidon, like the hesped for Hadad Rimon. Hadad Rimon was a non-Jewish king, but he's really talking about Achav, who defeated him. But Achav was, of course, killed. King Achav was much beloved to the Jewish people, and even though he wasn't such a big tzaddik by any means, he united the Jewish people. He won wars, and they gave an enormous eulogy for him. And the future eulogy will be even greater. V'safta ha'aretz mishpachot mishpachot levad, and all the families will come out as families and mourn and eulogize alone. Now we still don't know who they're eulogizing, but they're going to do that. Mishpachat be David levad, and the royal family will have their own eulogy center. V'nesheihim levad, and their wives will be separate. Which is actually very interesting. If you wanted to, in parentheses, try and find a source somewhere in Tanakh for separate seating at a wedding, this is the source they bring. That if at a funeral, and such a terrible mourning and disaster for the Jewish people, they have to separate the men and the women, which they seem to do, because of presumably they feel it'll, you know, not be the appropriate atmosphere if they don't separate them. Then even more so at a wedding when everybody's dancing and a little bit drunk and da 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 da. You should just know I'm not giving a halacha share about separate seating in weddings. This has been a halachic ping pong. In every generation, we tend to feel that we are today, we're the first people to experience these debates. But that's not true. If you go back even to the 16th, 17th century, you'll see that the Maharshal, Rosh Shlomo Luria, is incensed at separate people sitting together at weddings. And he says it causes terrible yetzer hara, and I've seen it with my own eyes, and maybe you can have the challah brought in for the sheva brachos, but then taken out. The women have to be said. In the same generation, the Levush, okay, Rav Mordechai Yaffa, who was one of the greatest halachists of his time, responds to the Maharshal and says, I don't know what you're talking about. We have mixed seating at weddings all the time. Not mixed dancing, mixed seating. And he says, and we manage. We don't explode. We don't melt down. Because men and women are used to being more mixed with each other. So it's okay. It's interesting. I'd love to do an academic study of whether there was a societal difference between, I don't know, the Jews of Krakow and the Jews of Lublin or whoever it was. But you see them even in the early 1600s having this argument that it could be today. You know, we could be this based in and that based in, etc. I'm not getting into that now. But okay, they're having this enormous hesped. So the Gemara says, second line number 7, Ha hesped the mai avidite. What is this eulogy for? Pligi bar Rabbi Dosa v'Rabbanan. So Rabbi Dosa and the rabbis disagree. Chad Amar, one says, Al Mashiach ben Yosef. They are mourning, they are eulogizing Mashiach ben Yosef, Shenerag, who is killed, V'chad Amar al Yetzer Hara Shenerag, which is what we just saw before. The other view is that they are eulogizing the loss of the evil inclination, which we just saw. That will be gone when Mashiach comes. Why would you be sad at the loss of the evil inclination? Because your opportunity to make real free will choices has been somewhat taken away. Right now is the moment you can really make the difference. Once you lose the inclination, you know, okay, that's nice, but, you know, it doesn't really count in the same way when you don't really want to do the wrong thing anyway. Fine, but I'm focused on Mashiach ben Yosef. They're mourning Mashiach ben Yosef, who is killed. Why is he killed? So let's keep on going. Number 8, we'll come back to that in a second. Says Yeshayahu, in those days, his messianic days, V'sara kinat Ephraim, the jealousy of Ephraim is Yosef, okay, in source number 8, Ephraim and Yosef are equated with each other because Ephraim is Yosef's son, the jealousy of Ephraim will be removed, V'tzorere Yehuda yiperesu, and those who afflict Yehuda will be cut down, taken away, Ephraim lo yikaneh Yehuda, Ephraim will not be jealous of Yehuda, V'Yehuda lo yitzoret Ephraim, and Yehuda will not afflict Ephraim. These two brothers, Yosef and Yehuda, finally getting on with each other. And says Rashi, Mashiach ben Yosef and Mashiach ben David lo yikanu zeh bezeh. You will have a synergy between Mashiach ben Yosef and Mashiach ben David. What is going on here? Why is Mashiach ben Yosef dying? Why is he being killed? What is this partnership? So I'm going to show you in a second a piece of Rav Kook, which I'm going to leave you to read on your own, mostly, but I'm going to introduce you to it if you don't know it already. Before that, we just need to look at Rav Sadugon. Look at number 9. Rav Sadugon, who was a rationalist, by the way. He was not a mystic. He was not a Kabbalist. He was not even a mystic. It says as follows, Ki al shnei inyanim yachad, there are two things that go together. He lived in the 10th century in Babylonia. Rav Saloma, what I want to tell you is this. In lo nachzor b'tshuva, if the Jewish people do not do tshuva, and again, tshuva means spiritual tshuva to God, and physical tshuva to the land, there's a whole joint meaning there. And all these times of Ben Yosef will come. And, you know, the Meforshim, the commentators talk about Mashiach Ben Yosef, there'll be this battle, this terrible war of Gog and Magog and the Jewish people, and Mashiach Ben Yosef will fight for the Jews and he will die, he'll be killed. All these terrible apocalyptic things could happen. I mean, there's been an apocalyptic tradition of the end of days, all the way since Sefer Daniel. We cite the Daniel towards the beginning, middle of the Second Temple, through this has been very much part of it. They're in that sort of tshuva, but if we do tshuva, then we can skip Mashiach Ben Yosef completely. So skip the apocalypse. Sounds like a good move, right? Okay? And by the way, Bahar Megiddo. This Hesper's happening in Megiddo. Megiddo is Armageddon. Armageddon is Har Megiddo. All of this comes to us in today's world as well. So Yira Lanu Mashiach Ben David Piton, and then Mashiach Ben David can come in a way which is more immediate. The Indian Mashiach Ben Yosef, or maybe if we get our act right and we do tshuva, and we could have Mashiach Ben Yosef Kodem Lo, before Mashiach Ben David, but not as an apocalypse, but rather Yir Keshaliach Lo, he'll be a Shaliach, he will be the harbinger of Mashiach Ben Yosef Ben David, Ukemetaken Ha'uma, he will fix up the nation, Ukemesakel Haderech, and pave the road. These are very, very important words by Rav Saadia Gaon. Meaning he's saying that I also subscribe to Mashiach Ben Yosef as an idea. Fine, he's not a Kabbalist, but that's an okay, it's not a Kabbalistic idea. And it could be a terrible time which Mashiach Ben Yosef is killed in this process in order to bring the final end of days. But it doesn't have to be. It could be, if we play our cards right, it could be a time where either we don't need Mashiach Ben Yosef, or he can act as a metaken. He can build the nation. He can fix the way and prepare the road for Mashiach Ben David. Now, this is actually very, very important. Because when you look, just on the last page for a second, I'm not going to read all of these words here, but I brought you a translation of something which is quite famous from Rav Kook, called The Lamentation in Jerusalem, on the death of Theodor Herzl. So let me give you a little bit of a backstory here as to how that works. Rav Kook, who is very much the founding father of religious Zionism — I started talking about religious Zionism when Rabbi Shaw came in, it's okay. But I was planning to do that anyway, even though I didn't know you were coming, so just so you know. Rav Kook, very much the founding father of religious Zionism. He was in Russia. He was a Rav in Russia. He grew up in Russia. He had a very interesting upbringing. His father was a Litvak, was a Mitnagid, against Hasidut in Revolution Yeshiva. And yet his mother was a Chabad Hasida, a really interesting Shidduch to start with. And he grew up in Russia in the 1880s, 1890s. He became a Rav in Russia. And he spoke a lot about the need to reform the Sanhedrin and bring the Sanhedrin back. And he saw the return of the Jewish people as a trickle in those days, but he saw it as a real thing. The students of the Gaon of Vilna were returning to Israel. Many Hasidim were returning to Israel. I mean, many compared to today was almost none. And what they achieved was so limited, but it was such a big sacrifice, and they made it. Eventually, Rav Kook was persuaded that he too should come to Israel. He came in 1904. He landed actually on the 28th of Iyar in Jaffa in 1904, which later would be Yom Yerushalayim. Obviously, he did not know that at that stage. It was 60 years earlier. He came to a community. He came to be the chief rabbi of Jaffa. So everyone was a bit suspicious of Rav Kook, because on the one hand, he looked like the classic old school rabbi, you know, beard, serious face, furry hat, you know, whatever he was. Well, at that stage, he didn't have a furry hat because he was not yet the chief rabbi of Jaffa. But whatever, he was seen by the new yeshuv, by the secular Zionists, as being part of the problem. You're with the religious Haredim, what we now call Haredim. They didn't call that then, the old yeshuv. But they were very nervous of him as being their new chief rabbi of Jaffa. Because Jaffa was a mixed community. There were secular Jews, there were religious Jews, there were Arabs, still are in some degree, very much so. And yet the religious Jews in Yerushalayim and Hebron and Sfat were very nervous of Rav Kook as well. Because they knew he was not a regular kind of yeshiva product. He was very independent. He was very redemption oriented. Even in the yeshiva, where he was the star of the Lozhin yeshiva, he did weird things like he spoke in Hebrew. Nobody spoke in Hebrew. He spoke in Hebrew. You know, even when everyone spoke in Yiddish, he was very Eretz Yisrael focused. So they were also nervous. Is he part of the new fangled yeshiva? So I imagine he came wanting to keep his head down, you know, relatively junior rabbi, or junior, he was a chief rabbi, he was in his 30s, and just like, keep your head down. He wasn't to know that about 3 weeks after he arrived in Jaffa, Theodor Herzl died. And of course, the secular Zionists in Jaffa came to him and said, you're the rabbi, you need to give a eulogy for Theodor Herzl. And the religious Jews came to him and said, you can't give a eulogy for Theodor Herzl because it says in the Shulchan Aruch that if you don't keep Shabbos and you don't keep kosher and you're completely not, and we're not talking about someone today who maybe doesn't keep Shabbat. He was a completely secular Jew in every respect, although he was in many ways the visionary of the you know, future Jewish state. He says, you can't give a hesped for him. He's just not allowed halachically. So what's he going to do? You know, what's he going to say? So what he stood up and said is this. This is just an extract from it, and I'd like you to read it later. I'm not going to read it all now because it's nearly 12:30. But basically what he said is as follows. He says, I'm not going to talk about Theodor Herzl at all. I'm going to talk about Mashiach ben Yosef. And he says basically that Mashiach ben Yosef and Mashiach ben David are these two forces in Judaism which constantly are in clashing with each other when the Judaism is out of sync with itself. Mashiach ben Yosef is the physical restoration of the Jewish people. Mashiach ben Yosef, like Yosef, is great in providing for the people. He can make money. Boy, can he make money. Jews are great at making money. They invent things. They in business, science. They win Nobel Prizes. He is the Egyptian Jew living as a tzaddik, but an Egyptian Jew. He has an Egyptian name. He has an Egyptian wife. He has an Egyptian house in Memphis. He does. Memphis, Egypt. Okay? And he has a big fancy Egyptian car, his big, chariot. He looks like an Egyptian, but he's a Jew being a big Kiddush Hashem in a non-Jewish world and making tons of money and providing for the Jews. That's one model. And then there's the Mashiach ben David model, which is completely alienated from that, which just wants to sit, wants to learn Torah, wants to do mitzvahs, completely raises walls. That's the Judah model. That's the Yehuda model that David is descended from. When Yaakov brings Yehuda to Egypt, it's to build walls, to build ghettos, as it were, to keep the non-Jewish world out. And says Rav Kook, these two visions within Judaism fight each other, but they fight each other because they don't yet realize they're meant to work together. The idea of Mashiach ben Yosef and Mashiach ben David being in alliance with each other, which was the vision we saw in Yeshayahu, says that's what it's meant to be. And that's what we call the birth pangs of Mashiach, when they're working against each other. He says, therefore, you have the secular Zionists, which effectively are Mashiach ben Yosef, because they are building the country. They are building the roads. They are building the economy. They are building the army. They are building all the things that a country needs to be a country. And then you have Mashiach ben David, who are the people who are sitting and learning Torah and preparing for all the spiritual revival. And at the moment, he says they're both working against each other. And then he turns to the secular Jews, read later, and says, you're destroying the world of Torah by your anti-Torah attitudes. And then he turns to the yeshivas and he says, look at you. He says, you're weak and you're sad. Weak and sad. How are you going to build a country? He says, work together, come together. And this, he said, is the vision of Mashiach ben Yosef. And therefore, this vision of Rav Kook became the manifesto for religious Zionism, this hesped that he gave, this eulogy that he gave for Theodor Herzl. Of course, everybody said to him at the end, oh, you just called Theodor Herzl Mashiach ben Yosef. And he says, no, I didn't. Read it again. I didn't say that, just, you know, whatever. And in the end, very much in Rav Kook's life, many people just felt that, you know, he was trying to please this side and trying to please this side and alienating everybody. But it may not be the case, because even though Rav Kook sometimes looks, you know, somewhat optimistic and maybe even we might think naive, he's not playing on a 10-year, 20-year, you know, time frame. He's looking at this in a decades and centuries time frame. And it could be that Rav Kook's ideas very much have been, you know, waiting to come into action. The religious Zionist community has seen itself and has often been frustrated in this vision as a bridge between, on the one hand, the Haredim, they can say, look, we learn Torah like you, and we keep mitzvahs like you, and the secular Jews, look, we fight in the army like you, and we build a country like you. Trying to be that bridge and being something for everybody ends up sometimes being nothing for nobody, but maybe you just have to keep going. So I'm just saying the Mashiach ben Yosef becomes a very relevant vision of Mashiach as well, and very much one which the Messianic, which the religious Zionist world brings. So I'll leave it there. There are, as I say, these three very important visions, and they interweave and they overlap somewhat: the practical vision of the Rambam, the mystical vision of the Ramban, the Mashiach ben Yosef, maybe apocalyptic, but maybe building the nation vision of Rav Kook there, and before him of Rav Sadia Gaon and others. So hopefully that will give you some categories to put these ideas into. I have on my website a number of much longer shirim on this, which you're welcome to go and listen to, and maybe we'll do a series at some stage together. So thank you for coming, and I hope you had a good morning, and I hope to see you again soon. Rabbi Shor, so nice to see you.
You can tell Rabbi Manning is British. He's pretty bang on time. And I must say, the whole day, we started on time. I don't know here, but certainly in Hendon where I was, it's very good. I just want to just close up, if that's okay. Keep you a few more minutes beyond 12:30. And also want to just start, obviously, Rabbi Manning's shiur. It's so ironic, because obviously at the moment, to realize the birth of Mizrahi, and I only learned this after I became the CEO, but Rabbi Reines, who founded our movement in 1902, had the same issues as Rav Kook, meaning he believed so passionately in the Zionist movement, but his co-religionists, who weren't yet called Haredim, who formed the Aguda, said there's no way we can actually have a Torah movement with the Zionists. You have to separate, and they formed the Aguda. And Rabbi Reines said, no, I'm going to create something called Merkaz Ruchani, which means the center of spirituality, which is Israel and Torah, and I'm going to remain within the World Zionist Organization, which Theodore Herzl has set up. And he formed Mizrahi in 1902. And again, there's certain moments in history where someone makes a decision, and I think it's one of those moments, because of that decision, Mizrahi remained inside the World Zionist Organization and has had a huge influence. 20 years later, they created their youth movement called Young Mizrahi. We know it better as B'nai Akiva. And it's amazing what sort of that world has done for the Jewish people and continues to do for the Jewish people. So why do I finish up here? At the back of your brochure, you have a page which said it's time to join. And this is simply an understanding that we're realizing now in Mizrahi, as we grow and doing more wonderful work with the shuls, and again, I'm sure I haven't heard yet how Rabbi Perez and Yalziki were over Shabbat, but I hope it was a very special Shabbat. And we want to do more of that. We want to expose the community to beautiful, inspiring teachers such as Rabbi Manning, and I'd love to bring Rabbi Manning back again to do a whole course with you. Why not? We'd love to. But again, there's a certain word that begins with M, ends with Oni, that is a problem. And what we've decided to do is to, we're not asking for £5,000 or £10,000. So if you want to give us that, we're very happy to. But we realize that people, deep down, I think all of us feel this connection to Israel, to the work we're doing with shuls and everything. So asking people to join, to become a monthly member of Mizrahi. You get wonderful benefits. You get the email once a week from me, which you get anyway. You don't have to join Mizrahi for that. But anyway, but you get HaMizrahi delivered to your door, which is amazing. And Rav Doron will call you every Friday night. He won't, but he said he would like to if he could. But you never know. You might get. I said to him, maybe I'll send you the list. Maybe you call one person and say Shabbat Shalom, whatever. But again, jokes aside, we just realise if we can get hundreds of people just saying, "Yeah, I'm a member," it will just help us to continue to do the work we're doing and expand what we're doing, because we see from this weekend, if everything we're doing, it's so needed, especially after October 7th. There's such a need to connect Anglo Jew with Midnight Israel, certainly with Torah Israel, and I'm glad I came at the end of your show, Rabbi Manning, because it's fascinating, and that Hesped is just, it's historical. It really is amazing to see. So thank you to Bournewood, to Joshua, and to Rabbi Robertson for helping us this week with, I think, what's been a success in Bournewood. And please join us in the continued mission we're doing for the community, and thank you for coming, and enjoy the rest of this lovely day.
Just on behalf of everybody here, just thank Rabbi Manning. Once again, a fascinating, fantastic show. Again, a finale for our weekend of inspiration. Rabbi Shor for being the driving force behind this weekend of inspiration. I know it has really inspired our community. It's been a wonderful Shabbat across all our sites here. And really, thank you for everything you've done. It's been a huge piece of work to do once again. We've done it, and I hope everyone here has really felt inspired and uplifted, and that deepened our connection both to Torah and to Torah Israel as well.